Wells and her late husband, Crosby. It was strange to him that the two had lived so many hundreds of miles apart, Lydia in Dunedin and Crosby in the depths of the Arahura Valley, a place that Lydia Wells never once visited, until now, nearly 2 weeks after the event of her husband's death. It was only for very superficial reasons of propriety that Gascoigne had not questioned Lydia directly about her marriage, for he was curious, and Lydia did not appear to be grieving in any visible sense. She became vague and foolish whenever Crosby's name was mentioned. But Lydia was shaking her head.
"No, no, no," she said. "Nothing to do with that. You must ask me what I have been doing since I saw you last. What I have been doing this very morning, in fact. I've been aching for you to ask. I cannot believe that you haven't asked.
Tell me, do."
Lydia sat erect and opened her grey eyes very wide so that they sparkled.
"I have bought an hotel," she said.
"An hotel," Gascoigne said, marvelling. "Which hotel?"
"This one."
"This? You think me capricious?"
She clapped her hands together.
"I think you enterprising and brave and very beautiful," said Gascoigne, "and a thousand other things. Tell me why you have bought this whole hotel."
"I intend to convert the place," Lydia said. "You know I'm a worldly woman. I owned a business in Dunedin for almost 10 years, and in Sydney before that. I am quite the entrepreneur, Aubert. You have not yet seen me in my element. You will think me very enterprising when you do."
Gascoigne looked about him.
"What conversions will you make?"
"We come at last to my vision," Lydia said. She leant forward. "Did you see the seance advertised in this morning's paper, with the date and location yet to be confirmed?"
"Oh, come, no."
Lydia raised her eyebrows.
"Oh, come, no, what?"
"Table-turning and spirits?"
Gascoigne smiled.
"A seance is an amusing foolishness, but it is not a business. You ought not to try to profit from a parlour trick. Folk get very angry when they suppose they are being cheated out of honest pay. And besides," he added, "the church is disapproving."
"You speak as if the art were not an art, as if the whole business were nothing more than a swindle,"
said Lydia Wells, who was made very bored by the disapproval of the church.
"The realm of the paranormal is not a trick, Aubert. The ether is not a cheat."
"Now come," Gascoigne said again. "This is entertainment you're speaking of, not prophecy. Let's not go talking about realms."
"So you are a cynic,"
she pretended to be disappointed.
"I would never have picked that. Disillusioned, maybe. Disbelieving, maybe. But tender underneath."
"If I am a cynic, I am a discerning cynic," Gascoigne said loftily. "I have been to several séances, Mrs. Wells. If I dismiss them as foolish superstition, I do not do it out of hand."
She hesitated, and then her plump hand shot out and pressed his sleeve.
"But I am being uncourteous. The subject is of some fascination to you," Gascoigne said, remembering himself.
"It's not that."
She stroked the fabric of his cuff a moment, and then withdrew her hand just as quickly.
"You are not to call me Mrs. Wells, not for very much longer."
Gascoigne bowed his head.
"You wish to be addressed now by your maiden name?" he asked, thinking privately that if this was true, it was a very improper wish indeed.
"No, no."
Lydia bit her lip and then leant in close and whispered,
"I am to be married."
"Married?"
"Yes, as soon as I dare. But it is a secret."
"A secret from me?"
"From everyone."
"I am not to know the name of your beloved?"
"No, not you nor anyone. It is my clandestine love affair,"
Lydia said. She giggled.
"Look at me, like a girl of 13 years preparing to elope. I dare not even wear his ring, though it is a fine one. A Dunstan ruby set in a band of Dunstan gold.
"I suppose I ought to offer my congratulations," Gascoigne said, cordially enough, but with a new reservation, for his hopes had been somewhat dashed by this news. He felt that a shaft of possibility had closed, a light had been extinguished, a door had slammed. Virtually since he first laid eyes upon the woman, Gascoigne had fantasized that Lydia Wells might one day become his lover. He had conjured her in his cottage, had seen her shaking out her russet locks at his bedside, had watched her stoking his range in the morning wrapped in a flannel robe. He had imagined the heady days of their early courtship, the construction of the house that they would share together, the passing years. Gascoigne dreamt all of this without shame or embarrassment, and even without conscious awareness that his mind was straying so. It had seemed simply natural. She was a widow, and he was a widower. They were both strangers in an unfamiliar town, and they had struck up a cordial acquaintance. It was not so very unlikely that they might fall in love. But now that he knew that Lydia Wells was betrothed, Gascoigne was forced to relinquish his fantasy, and to relinquish his fantasy, he had to acknowledge it and see it for the foolishness it was. At first he felt sorry for himself, but as soon as he turned his mind upon this sorrow, he found that its shallowness amused him.
"I am happiness itself," the widow said.
Gascoigne smiled. "What am I to call you, then, if I cannot call you Mrs. Wells?"
"Oh, Aubert," said the widow, "we are the very best of friends. You do not have to ask. Of course you must call me Lydia."
We will briefly interject with the correction that Aubert Gascoigne and Lydia Wells were not at all the very best of friends. In fact, they had known each other only 3 days. Gascoigne had first encountered the widow on Thursday afternoon, when the latter arrived at the magistrate's court to inquire after her late husband's fortune, a fortune that had already been found and banked by other men. Gascoigne filed Mrs. Wells' request to have the sale of the cottage revoked, and over the course of this transaction the pair fell to talking. The widow returned to the courthouse again on Friday morning, and Gascoigne, emboldened by the evident interest with which she appeared to regard him, begged to escort her to luncheon. She accepted this invitation with a coquettish astonishment, and Gascoigne, holding her parasol, accompanied her across the thoroughfare to Maxwell's dining hall, where he ordered 2 plates of barley soup, the whitest bread on offer, and a small carafe of dry sherry, and then seated her in pride of place next to the window. It quickly transpired that Lydia Wells and Aubert Gascoigne had much to talk about, and much in common. Mrs. Wells was very curious to learn all that had happened since her late husband's passing, a subject that naturally led Gascoigne to Anna Wetherill and her strange brush with death in the Canieri Road. Lydia Wells was further astonished by this, for as she explained, Anna Wetherill was known to her. The girl had stayed some weeks at her lodging-house in Dunedin before she struck out to make her living on the Hocketeeker Fields the previous year, and over this period the pair had become very close. It was at this point in the conversation that Lydia devised her surprise. Directly after their luncheon was cleared away, she dispatched Gascoigne to the Gridiron, where he informed Anna Wetherill that she was to be treated to a mystery shopping expedition the following afternoon at 2 o'clock. "If you have a fiancé and a new enterprise," said Gascoigne now, "then perhaps I am right to hope that your sojourn in Hocketeeker will not be a short one."
"One is always right to hope," said Lydia Wells, who had a fine store of rhetorical set pieces just like this one, and liked to pause dramatically after uttering them.
"Am I right to guess that your investment was made with the help of your fiancé? Perhaps he is a magnate of some kind." But the widow laughed.
"Aubert," she said, "you will not draw me out."
"I rather thought you expected me to try."
"Yes, but only to try," the widow said, "not to succeed."
"I fancy that is a feminine motif," Gascoigne said dryly.
"Perhaps," the widow returned, with a little laugh. "But we are a discriminating sex, and I fancy that you would not have it any other way."
What followed was a rather saccharine exchange of compliments, a game in which both the widow and the widower found themselves extremely well matched. Rather than transcribe this sentimental interchange, we will choose to talk above it, and instead describe in better detail what otherwise might be mistaken for a profound weakness in character on the Frenchman's part. Gascoigne was enraptured by Lydia Wells, and much admiring of the refined flamboyance of that woman's speech and manner, but he had not put his faith in her. He had not betrayed Anna Wetherill's confidence, and in his narration of the latter's story to Lydia, he had made no mention of the gold that had been discovered in Anna's orange dress the previous week, which was now wrapped in a flour sack and stowed beneath his bed. Gascoigne had also described the events of the 14th of January as if he believed that Anna had indeed attempted to take her life, sensing that, until a better explanation could be reached, it was prudent not to call attention to the evening's many mysteries. He knew very well that Anna had no notion of where on earth those midnight hours had gone, or, to phrase the matter a different way, of who on earth had stolen them, and he did not wish to place her in any kind of danger. Gascoigne therefore adhered to the official story, which was that Anna was a would-be suicide found insensate and wretched on the side of the road. He had adopted this perspective when discussing the event with other men, and it required no great effort to maintain it here. That Gascoigne was enraptured by Lydia Wells, and not instantly suspicious of her many caprices, is a point we cannot so easily defend. We do observe that the attraction had been formed before he even knew Lydia's reason for inquiring at the courthouse. It had been formed, in fact, before the widow even spoke her name. But now Gascoigne knew that Lydia bore a very mysterious relation to her late husband. Now he knew that the mysterious fortune that had been discovered in the dead man's cottage was currently in dispute. He knew that he ought not to trust her. And he knew that when he was with her, a pure and liquid adoration filled the chambers of his heart. Reason is no match for desire. When desire is purely and powerfully felt, it becomes a kind of reason of its own. Lydia's was a rare and old-world glamour, and Gascoigne knew it, just as if the fact had been logically proved. He knew that her sleekly feline features had been lifted, intact, from an older, better age. He knew that the shape of her wrist and ankle were without compare, and that her voice... But our point has already been made. We ought to return to the scene at hand. Gascoigne had set down his glass. "I think," he was saying, "that it is well you are to be married. You are far too charming to be a widow." "But perhaps," said Lydia Wells, "perhaps I'm far too charming to be another man's wife."
"Not at all," Gascoigne returned. "You are exactly as charming as another man's wife ought to be. It is only thanks to the likes of you that men get married at all. You make the idea of marriage seem very tolerable."
"Oh, Bear," she said, "you flatterer."
"I should like to flatter you further by inviting you to speak upon the subject of your expertise that I so inadvertently depreciated just now," the Frenchman said. "Come, Lydia, tell me about spirits and about the forces of the ether, and I shall try my very best to be naive and hopeful and not sceptical in the slightest."
How very lovely she was, with the muted light of the afternoon falling over her shoulder like a veil. How gorgeously the shadow filled that notch beneath her lip.
"Firstly," said Lydia Wells, drawing herself up, "you are mistaken to think that common folk will not pay to have their fortunes told. Men get very superstitious when the stakes are high, and a goldfield is a place of great risk and great reward. Diggers will always pay good money for a tip. Why, the word fortune is on their lips almost every day. They'll try their luck at anything if they think it might give them an edge upon the field. What is a speculator, anyway, but a gypsy wearing different clothes?"
Gascoigne laughed. "I doubt many speculators would appreciate that comparison," he said. "But yes, I take your point, Miss Lydia. Men are always happy to pay for advice. But will they trust in the efficacy of your advice,
The practical efficacy, I mean. I fear it will be an extraordinary pressure, for you will have to bear up beneath the burden of proof. How will you ensure you won't lead any one of them astray?
What a terrifically dreary question, said Lydia Wells. You doubt my affinity to my subject, I suppose.
Gascoigne did, but he chose to dissemble for the sake of politeness.
I don't doubt it, he said, but I am ignorant of it. I am intrigued.
I have owned a gambling house for a decade, the widow said. My gambling wheel has stopped upon the jackpot only once in all that time, and that was because the pin jammed in the pivot on account of grit. I had the wheel weighted in such a way that the prize nearest the jackpot always fell against the arrow. As a secondary precaution, the pegs on either side of the number were greased. The arrow always slid past at the final moment, but so barely and so tantalizingly that the men could not help but clamber up and throw down their shillings for another spin.
"Why, Miss Lydia," said Gascoigne, "that is devilishly unfair."
"Not at all," said Lydia.
"Of course it is," said Gascoigne. "It is cheating."
"Answer me this," said Lydia Wells. "Do you call a grocer a cheat for placing the choicest apples at the back of the cart so the blemished fruits will get chosen first?"
"It hardly compares," said Gascoigne.
"Tosh, it compares perfectly," said the widow. "The grocer is making sure of his income, for if he placed the choicest apples in front, the blemished fruits would not be bought until they had gone over to mould, and they would have to be discarded. He ensures a steady income for himself by encouraging each one of his customers to settle for a piece of fruit that is slightly, ever so slightly, defective. I must also make sure of my income if I am to remain in business, and I do it in exactly this same way. When a gambler goes home with only a small reward, say £5, and a sense that he came within a hair's breadth of a perfectly enormous fortune, it is as if he has gone home with a blemished apple. He has a modest reward, a pleasant memory of a very fine evening, and the sense of having just fallen short of something absolutely extraordinary. He's happy, more or less, and so am I."
Gascoigne laughed again. "But gambling is a vice," he said. "A blemished apple is not a vice. Forgive me, I do not mean to be dreary, but it seems that your example, like your gambling wheel, is heavily weighted to favour your own position."
"Of course gambling is a vice," said the widow scornfully. "Of course it's a terrible sin and a scourge, and it ruins men and all the rest of it. What do I care about that? Try telling a grocer that you do not care for apples. No matter, he'll tell you, there are plenty of others who like them just fine."
Gascoigne saluted her in the military style. "I am persuaded of your ability to persuade," he said. "You are a force to be reckoned with, Miss Lydia. I pity that poor fellow who won that jackpot, who had to come to you afterwards and demand his winnings."
"Oh, yes, but I never paid out," said Lydia Wells.
Gascoigne was incredulous.
"You defaulted on your own jackpot?"
She tossed her head.
"Who's defaulting?" she said. "I only gave him a second option. I told him that he could have the £100 in pure, or he could have me."
"Not as a whore," she said, seeing the look on Gascoigne's face.
"As a wife, silly."
"That was Crosby. He made his choice, and you know which way he chose."
Gascoigne's mouth had fallen open. "Crosby Wells?"
"Yes," said the widow. "We were married before the night was over. What, Aubert, I certainly didn't have £100 to give away. I never dreamt the wheel would ever come to rest upon the bonanza. I had weighted it so that would never happen. I could hardly have made good. I would have ruined myself altogether. I would have been bankrupted. You cannot be shocked."
"I confess I am a little," Gascoigne said, though his shock was of a most admiring kind. "Why, were you at all acquainted with the man?"
Of course not, said Lydia Wells. What modern notions you have.
Gascoigne blushed. I did not mean that, he said, and then, rushing on, of course, if you were preventing your own financial ruin, as you say.
We were terribly ill-suited, of course, and within the month we could not stand the sight of one another. It was to be expected. Yes, it was the best that either of us could have expected, given the circumstances.
Gascoigne was wondering why the pair had not arranged a divorce, but he could not ask this question without offending the widow's propriety, and merely nodded.
You see, I am very modern about that, Lydia added. You must agree with my circumspection on that score. To insist upon a separation above a divorce. You have been married, Mr. Gascoigne.
He noticed the coquettish use of his family name and smiled at her.
Yes, he said, but let us not talk of the past. Let us talk of the present and the future and all that lies ahead. Tell me about the conversions you will make to this hotel.
Lydia was pleased to be given the stage. She leapt to her feet, and clasping her hands together in the pose of a chorister, stepped forward around the ottoman. Turning on her heel, she cast her gaze around the parlour, at the mullioned window, the thinly plastered walls, the threadbare Union Jack, no doubt salvaged from a wreck, which was tacked vertically to the wall that faced the window.
I will change the name, of course, she said. It will no longer be the Wayfarer. It will be the Wayfarer's Fortune.
There's music in that.
This satisfied her. She took a few steps away from the sofa and spread her arms.
I will have drapes. I cannot abide a room without drapes. And fainting couches, in the modern style. In the drawing room there will be a cubicle with saloon doors, rather like a confessional. Very like a confessional. The front parlour will be a waiting room of sorts. The seances I will conduct here, of course. Oh, I have every kind of idea. I will read fortunes and draw up cosmic birth charts and play out the patterns of the tarot. Upstairs! But what is this? You are still sceptical, Aubert?
I am no longer a sceptic. I have recanted, said Gascoigne, reaching out to clasp her hand,
a movement that was spurred partly because he was trying to smother a smile. He was a sceptic through and through, and he could not hear her roll the R of tarot without wanting to burst with laughter. Squeezing her hand, he added, I should very much like to be rewarded for recanting.
In this matter I am the expert and you are the layman, said Lydia Wells. You ought to remember that, no matter your poor opinion of realms.
Her arm was extended between them limply, as a lady extends her rings to be kissed, and Gascoigne repressed the urge to snatch it up and kiss it.
You are right, he said, squeezing her hand again. You are quite right.
He released her, and she moved away to the mantel.
I will reward you with a fact, she said, but on the condition that you must take me very seriously, quite as seriously as you would take any other man.
Of course, Gascoigne murmured, becoming solemn. He sat back.
Here it is, said Lydia Wells. Next month will be a month without a moon.
Dear me, said Gascoigne.
It will never wax completely full, is what I mean. February is a short month. There will be a full moon just prior to the first, and another just after the 28th, and so no full moon in February.
Gascoigne smiled at her. And does it fall so every year?
Not at all, said Lydia. The phenomenon is very rare.
She ran her finger along the plaster moulding. Rare implies a value, does it not? Or a danger?
It happens only once every score of years,
Lydia continued, straightening the carriage clock. And what does it prophesy, Miss Lydia?
A month without a moon.
Lydia Wells turned to him and placed her hands upon her hips.
If you give me a shilling, she said, I'll tell you.
Gascoigne laughed. Not yet, he said. I don't yet have proof of your expertise. I shall have to test you before I part with any money, or anything else that belongs to this realm.
The cloud will be down tonight, but I will check the Monday papers and look up the tides."
The widow gazed at him impenetrably.
"I'm not mistaken," she said. "I've an almanac, and I'm very skilled at reading it. The moon is waxing now above the cloud. It will be full by Monday night, and on Tuesday it will begin to wane. Next month will be a month without a moon."
Conjunctions, in which poor impressions are restored, the invitations multiply, and the past rolls forward to touch the present hour. The Reverend Cowell Devlin had remained in the dining room of the Palace Hotel until the middle hours of the afternoon, whereupon he began to feel thick-headed and slow, and his reading ceased to be profitable. Judging himself to be in need of fresh air, he drained his coffee, stowed his pamphlets, paid his bill, turned his collar up against the rain, and set off along the beach front, heading north. The afternoon sun was bright above the cloud, lending to the scene a silvery glow that leached the sea of colour and picked out points of white light in the sand. The very raindrops seemed to shimmer in the air. The wind, blowing chill from the ocean, carried with it a pleasant, rusty smell. All this did much to dispel Devlin's torpor, and in very little time at all he was red-cheeked and smiling, his wide-brimmed hat clamped tight to his head with the palm of his hand. He decided to make the most of his perambulation and return to Hokitika via the high terrace of Sea View, the site of the future Hokitika jail and Devlin's own future residence. Upon gaining the crest of the hill, he turned, panting slightly, and was surprised to see that he was being pursued. A young man, clad only in a twill shirt and trousers, both of which were plastered wetly to his body, was ascending the track to the terrace at a great pace. The man's head was down, and he was not immediately identifiable. It was not until he came within 20 yards of Devlin that the latter recognized him. Why, he thought, it was the man from the Arahura Valley, the Maori man, friend of the late Crosby Wells. Cowell Devlin had not trained as a missionary, and had not journeyed to New Zealand for that purpose. It had been quite to his surprise when he discovered that the New Testament had been translated into Maori some 20 years prior to his arrival. He was even more astonished to learn that the translation was available for public purchase at the stationers on George Street in Dunedin at a very reasonable price. Turning the pages of the translated document, Devlin had wondered how the holy message had been simplified, and at what cost. The unfamiliar words in their truncated alphabet seemed infantile to him, composed of repeating syllables and babble, unrecognizable, like the nonsense of a child. But in the next moment Devlin chastised himself, for what was his own Bible but a translation of another kind? He ought not to be so hasty or so prideful. In penance for his unvoiced doubt, he took out his pocketbook and made a careful note of some key verses from the Maori text. He aroha te atua, e aroha anatatau kia ia, no te ea ko ia kua matua aroha kia tatau. Ko ahau te huarahi te pono te ora, Hone 14:6, he wrote, and then, marvelling, from the epistles of Paora. The translator had even changed the names. The Maori man looked up. Seeing Devlin standing on the ridge above him, he stopped, and from a distance of several yards they regarded each other, saying nothing. A sudden gust of wind flattened the tussock around where Devlin stood, blowing his hair back from his temples. "Good afternoon," he called.
"Good afternoon,"
returned the other, squinting slightly.
"I see that we are neither of us deterred by a spot of foul weather."
"Yes."
"The view is rather compromised. That's the only shame,"
Devlin added, throwing out his arm to include the shrouded vista before them.
"It seems that we might be anywhere on earth, when the clouds come down, do you not think? I fancy that when they clear again, we shall find ourselves in an altogether different place."
The terrace of Sea View, aptly named, had a singular prospect of the ocean, which from this height was a featureless expanse, a fat band of uniform colour, with the sky a lighter shade of the same. The shoreline was not visible from the terrace, owing to the steepness of the cliff below. The edge gave out abruptly into a scree of loose stones and clay, and the blankness of this vista, trisected into earth, water, air, with no trees to interrupt the level, and no contour to soften the shape of the land, alarmed one's senses to the point that one was soon compelled to turn one's back upon the ocean altogether, and to face the eastern mountains instead, which were obscured today by a shifting curtain of white cloud. Below the terrace, the clustered roofs of Hokitika gave way to the wide brown plain of the Hokitika River and the grey curve of the spit. Beyond the river, the coastline bore away southward, blurring with haze and distance until it was swallowed absolutely by the mist.
"It is a good vantage," said the Maori man.
"It most certainly is. Though I must say that I have yet to come across a view I did not like in this country."
Devlin descended several steps, thrusting out his hand.
"Here, my name is Carl Devlin. I am afraid I don't remember yours."
"Te rau taufari."
"Te rau taufari,"
Devlin repeated solemnly.
"How do you do?"
Taufari was not familiar with this idiom, and paused to puzzle over it. While he was doing so, Devlin went on.
"You were a very good friend of Crosby Wells, I remember."
"His only friend," Taufari corrected.
"Ah, but even to have one good friend, a man should count himself lucky."
Taufari did not respond to this at once. After a moment he said,
"I taught him Kōrero Māori."
Devlin nodded.
"You shared your language. You shared the stories of your people. It is a fine friendship that is built from that kind of stone."
"Yes."
"You called Crosby Wells your brother," Devlin went on. "I remember it. You spoke the very word that night at the police camp, the night before his body was interred."
"It is a figure of speech."
"Yes, it is, but the sentiment behind it is very fine. Why did you say it, if not to say simply that you cared for the man and loved him as you would love your own? Brother is another word for love, I think. The love we choose to give, and gladly."
Taufari thought about this and then said,
"Some brothers you cannot choose."
"Ah," said Devlin, "no, indeed. We cannot choose our blood, can we? We cannot choose our families. Yes, you draw a nice distinction there. Very nice."
"And within a family," Taufari went on, encouraged by this praise, "two brothers can be very different men."
Devlin laughed.
"Right again," he said. "Brothers can be very unalike. I had only sisters, you know. Four sisters, and all of them older. They made quite a pet of me."
He paused, meaning to give Taufari the opportunity to volunteer information about his own family. But Taufari only repeated his observation about brothers a second time, seeming well pleased with his own perspicacity.
"I wonder, Te Rau, if I might ask you something about Crosby Wells," said Devlin suddenly,
for he had not forgotten the story that he had overheard that morning in the dining room of the Palace Hotel. The politician Alistair Lauderback had been convinced, for some mysterious reason, that the late Crosby Wells and the blackmailer Francis Carver had been brothers, despite the fact that they did not appear to share a name. Why Lauderback believed this, however, he had refused to say. Perhaps Taufari, as Wells' great friend, knew something about it. Taufari was frowning.
"Do not ask me about the fortune," he said. "I know nothing of the fortune. I have been questioned already by the magistrate and by the police and by the keeper of the jail. I do not want to give my answers another time."
"Oh, no, I am not interested in the fortune," Devlin said. "I wanted to ask you about a man named Carver, Francis Carver."
Taufari stiffened.
"Why?"
"I heard that he was an old acquaintance of Mr. Wells. Apparently, there's some unfinished business between the two of them. Something criminal."
Taufari said nothing. His eyes were narrowed.
"Do you know anything about it?" Devlin said.
When, on the morning of the 14th of January, Tirau Tafari had told Francis Carver, for a price of 2 shillings, where Crosby Wells was living. He had not felt as though he were placing his friend in any kind of danger. The offer itself was not unusual, and nor was the manner of its expression. Men often offered rewards for news of fellows who had been lost upon the goldfields. Not only brothers, but fathers, uncles, sons, debtors, partners, and mates. There was the missing persons page in the newspaper, of course, but not every digger could read, and still fewer had the time or the inclination to keep abreast of the daily news. It was cheaper, and sometimes more efficient, to offer a reward by word of mouth instead. Taufare collected his 2 shillings quite happily. When later that same evening he saw Carver approach Wells' cottage, knock, and enter, it did not occur to him to be suspicious. He decided that he would sleep the night on the ridge beside his snares, so that Carver and Wells might conduct their reunion in private. He assumed that Carver was an old associate from Wells' years in Dunedin, and did not speculate beyond this assumption. The following morning, however, Wells was found dead. On the day of his funeral, a phial of laudanum was discovered under his cot. Some days after that, it was revealed that Carver's ship, the Godspeed, had departed on the night of the 14th of January, off schedule, and under the cover of darkness. Taufare was horrified. All evidence seemed to point to the fact that Francis Carver had played a part in the hermit's death, and if this was true, then it was Tirau Taufare who had equipped him with the means to do so by telling him explicitly where Wells could be found. Still more horrible, he had received payment for his betrayal. Taufare's sense of self-mastery, integral to his self-conception, did not permit unwitting action. The knowledge that he had betrayed his friend for money was deeply shaming to him, and this shame manifested as a disgusted outrage that was directed both inward and outward at once. He spent the days following Wells' burial in a very black humour, grinding his teeth, pulling on his forelock, and cursing Francis Carver with every step. Devlin's inquiry prompted a renewal of this ill humour. Taufare's eyes flashed, and his chin lifted.
"If there is unfinished business between them," he said angrily, "it is finished now."
"Of course," Devlin said, raising his palms to pacify the other man's temper. "But here, I heard a rumour somewhere that they were brothers. Crosby Wells and Carver. It might only be a figure of speech, as you put it, but I wanted to make sure." Taufare was bewildered by this. To cover his bewilderment, he scowled at the chaplain very darkly. "Do you know anything about it?"
"No,"
Taufare said, spitting out the word.
"Wells never mentioned a man named Carver to you?"
"No."
Devlin, perceiving that Taufare's mood had soured, decided to try a different approach.
"How did Crosby Wells get on then, learning Maori?"
"Not as good as my English," said Taufare.
"That I do not doubt. Your English is extremely good."
Taufare lifted his chin.
"I have travelled with surveyors. I have led many men over the mountains."
Devlin smiled.
"Do you know," he said, "I believe I feel a touch of the kindred spirit in you, Tirau. I think that we are not so very different, you and I. Sharing our stories, sharing our language, finding brothers in other men. I think that we are not so very different at all."
Here Devlin spoke whimsically rather than perceptively. His years as a clergyman had taught him that it was prudent always to begin upon a point of connection, or to forge one if a connection did not yet exist. This practice was not dishonest exactly, but it was true that, if pressed, Devlin would not have been able to describe this apparent similarity in any great detail before devolving into generality.
"I am not a man of God," said Taufare, frowning.
"And yet there is much of God in you," Devlin replied. "I believe you must have an instinct for prayer, Tirau, to have come here today, to pay respects at your dear friend's grave, to pray over him indeed."
Taufare shook his head.
"I don't pray for Crosby. I remember him."
"That's all right," Devlin said. "That's fine. Remembering is a very good place to start.
Smiling slightly, he pressed the pads of his fingers together and then tilted both hands downwards, his clerical pose.
Prayers often begin as memories. When we remember those whom we have loved and miss them, naturally we hope for their safety and their happiness, wherever they might be. That hope turns into a wish, and whenever a wish is voiced, even silently, even without words, it becomes a supplication. Perhaps we don't know to whom we're speaking. Perhaps we ask before we truly know who's listening, or before we even believe that listener exists. But I judge it a very fine beginning to make a practice of remembering those people we have loved. When we remember others fondly, we wish them health and happiness and all good things. These are the prayers of a Christian man. The Christian man looks outward, T. Rao. He loves others first, himself second. This is why the Christian man has many brothers, alike and unalike. For none of us are so dissimilar, would you not agree, when perceived from a collective point of view?
We do perceive from the advantage of this collective point of view that Te Rau Taufari and Cowell Devlin are indeed very similar in a great many ways. The most pertinent of these, however, are to go both unobserved and unremarked. Neither man possesses curiosity enough to disturb the other's prideful equanimity, nor truly to draw him out. They are to stand forever proximal, one the act of his own self-expression, the other the proof of it.
A prayer needn't always be a supplication, of course, Devlin added. Some prayers are expression of gladness, some are expressions of thanks. But there is hope in all good feeling, Te Rau, even in feelings that remember the past. The prayerful man, the good man, is always hopeful. He's always an optimist. A man is made hopeful by his prayers.
Taufari, who had received this sermon doubtfully, only nodded.
These are wise words, he added, feeling pity for his interlocutor.
In general, Taufari's conception of prayer was restricted to the most ritualized and oratorical sort. The ordered obeisance of the Fai Corero produced in him, as did all rituals of speech and ceremony, a feeling of centrality and calm, the likes of which he could not manufacture alone, and nor did he wish to. The sensation was quite distinct from the love he felt for his family, which he experienced as a private leaping in his breast, and distinct, too, from the pride he felt in himself, which he felt as a pressurized excitement, an elated certainty that no man would ever match him, and no man would ever dare to try. It ran deeper than the natural goodness that he felt, watching his mother shuck muscles and pile the slippery meat into a wide-mouthed flax basket on the shore, and knowing as he watched her that his love was good and wholly pure. It ran deeper than the virtuous exhaustion he felt after a day stacking the Rua Kumara, or hauling timber, or plaiting harakeke until the ends of his fingers were pricked and raw. Te Rau Taufari was a man for whom the act of love was the true religion, and the altar of this religion was one in place of which no idols could be made.
"Shall we go to the grave together?" Devlin said.
The wooden headstone that marked Crosby Wells' grave had surrendered already to the coastal climate. 2 weeks following the hermit's death, the wooden plaque was already swollen, the face already spotted with a rime of black mould. The indentation of the cooper's engraving had softened, and the thin accent of paint had faded from white to a murky yellow-grey, giving the impression not altogether dispelled by the stated year of his death that the man had been deceased for a very long time. The plot was yet unseeded by lichen or grass, and despite the rain had a barren look, not of earth recently turned, but of earth that had settled and would not be turned again. The favoured epitaphs here were chiefly beatitudes from Matthew, or oft-quoted verses from the Psalms. Injunctions to sleep and be at peace did not reassure, however, as they might have done in some hedged and cobbled parish 10,000 miles away. It was in the company of the lost and the drowned that Crosby Wells lay at his eternal rest, for there were yet only a handful of headstones in the plot at Sea View, and most of them were memorials erected in honour of vessels that had been wrecked or lost at sea. The Glasgow, the city of Dunedin, the New Zealand, as though entire cities, entire nations had been bound for the coast, only to run aground or sink or disappear. On the hermit's right was a memorial to the brigantine Oak, the first ship to founder at the mouth of the Hokitika River, a fact engraved with forbidding premonition upon the greenish stone. On Wells' left was a wooden headstone barely larger than a plaque, which bore no name at all, only a verse, unattributed, "My times are in your hand." None too far from the cemetery was the site of George Shepherd's future jailhouse, the foundations of which had been paced and measured out already, the dimensions marked in white lead paint upon the soil. It was the first time that Taufari had ventured to sea view since Wells' interment, a ceremony that had taken place before a small and perfunctory audience, and despite very heavy rain. In these aspects, and in the general speed with which the conventional blessings were dispatched, Wells' funeral had seemed to embody every kind of inconvenience and every kind of dreariness. Needless to say, Te Rau Taufari had not been invited to contribute to the proceedings. In fact, George Shepherd had specifically enjoined him, with an ominous wag of his large knuckled finger, to keep silent during all but the chaplain's Amen, a chorus to which Taufari did not, in the event, add his voice, for Devlin's benediction was quite swallowed in the downpour. He was permitted to assist in lowering Wells' coffin down into the mud of the hole, however, and in depositing 30, 40, 50 shovelfuls of wet earth after it. He should have liked to do this alone, for the party made short work of filling the hole, and it seemed to Taufari that everything was over far too soon. The men, pulling their collars up about their ears, buttoned their coats, took up their earth-spattered tools, and trooped single file back down the muddy switchback to the warmth and light of Hokitika proper, where they shucked their greatcoats and wiped their faces dry and changed their sodden boots for indoor shoes. Taufari came silently upon the grave of his friend, Devlin following, his hands folded, his expression peaceful. Taufari halted some 5 or 6 feet from the wooden headstone, and looked upon the plot as though upon a deathbed from a chamber doorway, as though fearing to step bodily into the room. Taufari had never seen Crosby Wells beyond the Arahura Valley. He had certainly never seen him here, upon this forsaken terrace ravaged by the sky. Had the man not said countless times that it was in the solitary Arahura that he wished to end his days? It was senseless that he should have been laid to rest here, among men who were not his brethren, upon soil he had not worked and did not love, while his dear old cottage stood empty and abandoned some dozen miles away. It was that soil that ought to have claimed him. It was that earth that ought to have turned his death to fertile life. It was in the Arahura, Taufari thought, that he ought to have been buried in the end, at the edge of the clearing, perhaps, or by the plot of his tiny garden, or on the north-facing side of the cottage in a patch of sun. Te Rau Taufari came closer, into the phantom chamber, to the foot of the phantom bed. A wave of guilt overcame him. Ought he to confess to the chaplain, after all, that he, Taufari, had led Crosby to his death? Yes, he would make his confession, and Devlin would pray for him as though for a Christian man. Taufari squatted down upon his haunches, placed a careful palm over the wet earth that covered Crosby's heart, and held it there. "Weeping may endure for the night, but joy cometh in the morning," Devlin said.
"Fatung haro haro hitangata toito he fenua."
"May the Lord keep him. May the Lord keep us as we pray for him."
Taufari's palm had made an indentation in the soil. Seeing this, he lifted his hand a little, and with his fingertips, smoothed the print away. At the West Coast Times office on Weld Street, Benjamin Löwenthal's Shabbat was just coming to an end. Charlie Frost found him sitting at his kitchen table, finishing his supper. Löwenthal was rather less pleased to see Frost than he had been to see Thomas Balfour early that afternoon, for he guessed, rightly, that Frost was come to speak about the estate of Crosby Wells, a subject of which he had long since tired. He welcomed Frost into his kitchen courteously, however, and invited the young banker to take a seat. Frost, for his part, did not apologize for interrupting Löwenthal's devotions, for he was not worldly, and he did not know them to be devotions. He sat down at the ink-stained table, thinking it very strange that Löwenthal had cooked himself such an elaborate supper only to partake of it alone. The candle he took for an eccentricity. He glanced at it only once. "It's about the estate," he said. Löwenthal sighed.
"Bad news, then," he said. "I might have guessed it."
Frost gave a brief summary of what had transpired in Chinatown that afternoon, describing Mannering's former grievances with Ah Kui in some detail.
"Where's the bad news?" Löwenthal said when he was done.
"I'm afraid your name came up," said Frost, speaking delicately.
"In what context?"
"It was suggested," even more delicately, "that perhaps this fellow Lauderback used you as a pawn on the night of the 14th. In coming straight to you, I mean, on the night of the hermit's death, and telling you all about it. Maybe, just possibly, he came to you by some sort of design."
"That's absurd," Löwenthal said. "How was Lauderback to know that I'd go straight to Edgar Clinch? I certainly never mentioned Edgar's name to him, and he said nothing out of the ordinary to me."
Frost spread his hands. "Well, we're making a list of suspects, that's all. And Mr. Lauderback is on that list."
"Who else is on your list?"
"A man named Francis Carver."
"Ah," said Löwenthal. "Who else?"
"The widow Wells, of course."
"Of course. Who else?"
"Miss Wetherall," said Frost. "And Mr. Staines." Löwenthal's face was inscrutable.
"A broad taxonomy," he said.
"Continue." Frost explained that a small group of men were meeting at the Crown Hotel after nightfall in order to pool their information and discuss the matter at length. The group was to include every man who had been present in Kui Long's hut that afternoon, Edgar Clinch, the purchaser of Wells' estate, and Joseph Pritchard, whose laudanum had been found in the hermit's cottage following the event of Wells' death. Harold Nielsen had vouched for Pritchard's character. He, Frost, had vouched for Clinch.
"You vouched for Clinch," said Löwenthal.
Frost confirmed this, and added that he would be happy to vouch for Löwenthal, too, if Löwenthal was desirous to attend. Löwenthal pushed his chair back from the table.
"I will attend," he said, standing and moving to fetch a box of matches from the shelf beside the door. "But there's someone else, I think, ought to be present also."
Frost looked alarmed. "Who is that?" Löwenthal selected a match and struck it against the door jamb.
"Thomas Balfour," he said, tilting the match and watching the small flame climb along the shaft. "I believe that his information may be of considerable value to the project of our discussion, if he is willing to share it, of course."
He lowered the match carefully into the sconce above the table.
"Thomas Balfour?" Frost repeated.
"Thomas Balfour's a shipping agent," Löwenthal said.
He turned the dial to widen the aperture. There was a hiss, and the globe flared orange-red.
"He came to you this morning, did he not? I think he mentioned that he had seen you at the bank."
Frost was frowning. "Yes, he did," he said. "But he asked some mighty strange questions, and I wasn't altogether sure of his purpose, to tell you the truth."
"That's just it," Löwenthal said, shaking out the match. "There's another dimension to this whole business, and Tom knows about it. He told me this afternoon that Alistair Lauderback is sitting on a secret, something big. He might be unwilling to break Lauderback's confidence, of course. He kept his peace with me. But if I put the matter to him in the context of this assembly, well, he can be the master of his own choice. He can make up his own mind."
Perhaps once everyone else has shared his own peace, he might be moved to speak.
To speak? Frost repeated. All right. But can he be trusted to listen?
Löwenthal paused, pinching the charred match between his finger and his thumb.
Please correct me if I am mistaken, he said coldly, but I understood from your invitation that this is to be an assembly of innocent men, not of schemers or conspirators or felons of any kind.
That's right, said Frost, but even so...
And yet you ask whether Tom can be trusted to listen, Löwenthal went on. Surely you are not in possession of any information that might indict you? Surely you know nothing that you would not want to share aloud and freely with a company of innocents united by a common cause?
Of course not, said Frost, blushing, but we still need to be cautious.
Cautious, Löwenthal said.
He dropped the match into the woodpile and rubbed his fingertips together.
I am beginning to doubt your better interests, Mr. Frost. I am beginning to wonder whether this is not a kind of conspiracy after all.
They looked at each other for a long moment, but Frost's will was not equal to Löwenthal's. He ducked his head, his cheeks flaming, and nodded once.
You should invite Mr. Balfour. Certainly, he said. Certainly you should.
Löwenthal clucked his tongue. His manner could be very schoolmasterly when his code of ethics was aggrieved. His reprimands were always stern and always effective. He gazed at the younger man now with a very sorrowful expression, causing Frost to blush still more furiously, like a schoolboy who has been caught doing violence to a book.
Wishing to redeem himself, Frost said somewhat wildly, And yet there are things about the sale of the cottage that are not yet public knowledge, that Mr. Clinch would not like to be made public, I mean.
Löwenthal's look was almost smouldering.
Let me make this very clear, he said. I trust in your discretion just as you trust in mine, and just as we both trust in the discretion of Mr. Clinch. But discretion is a far cry from secrecy, Mr. Frost. I do not consider that any of us is withholding information in the legal sense, do you?
In a voice that pretended to be casual, Frost said, Well, I suppose we can only hope that Mr. Clinch is of your mind, meaning somewhat foolishly to curry Löwenthal's favour by applauding his rationale. But Löwenthal shook his head.
Mr. Frost, he said, you are indiscreet. I do not advise it.
Benjamin Löwenthal hailed from Hanover, a city that, since his departure from Europe, had fallen under Prussian rule. With his walrus moustache and severely receded hairline, Löwenthal was not unlike Otto von Bismarck, but the correlation was not an imitative one. Imitation was not a form of self-styling that Löwenthal had ever thought to adopt. He was the eldest son of a textiles merchant, a man whose life's ambition had centred wholly upon giving both his sons an education. This aspiration, to the old man's immeasurable gratification, he achieved. Soon after the boy's studies were completed, however, both parents contracted influenza. They died, as Löwenthal was later informed, upon the very day that the Jewish people were granted formal emancipation by the Hanoverian state. This event was young Löwenthal's watershed. Although he was not superstitious, and so attached no real value to the fact that these events happened contemporaneously, they were nevertheless linked in his mind. He felt a profound sense of detachment from either circumstance by virtue of their happening on the very same day. At that time he had just been offered a newspaperman's apprenticeship at Die Henne in Ilmenau, an opportunity that both his parents would surely have encouraged him to seize. But because the state of Thuringia had not yet formally emancipated its Jewish citizens, he felt that it would be disrespectful to his parents' memory to accept. He was torn. Löwenthal cherished an outsized fear of catastrophe and was prone to overanalysis in self-contemplation. His reasons for his actions were always many and rationalized in the extreme. We shall pass over these reasons why, and remark only that Löwenthal chose neither to move to Ilmenau nor to remain in Hanover.
Immediately following his parents' deaths, he left Europe altogether, never to return. His brother Heinrich took over their father's business in Hanover, and Benjamin Löwenthal, degree in hand, sailed across the Atlantic to America, where for the months and years and decades after that, he recounted this very history to himself in exactly these words, in exactly this way. Repetition is a fortification like no other. Over time, Löwenthal's conception of the story of his past had become fixed and, by virtue of its fixity, unassailable. He lost the capacity to talk about his life in any other terms but those he had prescribed, that he was a moral man, that he was a man confronted with paradox, that he was a man who had done the right thing, who did the right thing, who would do the right thing. All of his choices, in his mind, had been moral choices. He ceased to be able to distinguish between personal preference and moral imperative, and he ceased to accept that such a distinction was possible. It was as a consequence of all of this that he chastised Charlie Frost so freely now. Frost's eyes were lowered.
"I can be discreet," he said quietly. "You needn't worry about me."
"I will go and speak to Tom myself," Löwenthal said,
crossing the room in two strides and holding open the door for the banker to leave.
"I thank you for the invitation. I shall see you tonight at the Crown."
Dick Mannering, upon returning from Canieri, had gone at once to the Gridiron Hotel, where he found Edgar Clinch alone in his private office, sitting at his desk. The magnate sat down without invitation, talked for some time about the afternoon's occurrences, and very swiftly described the proposed conference that was to take place that evening. The men had decided, for reasons of prudence, to meet upon neutral ground, and the smoking room of the Crown Hotel, as the least attractive room of the least popular establishment in all of Hokitika, had seemed to all the assembled company to be a very sensible choice. Mannering talked with great exuberance, for he liked the idea of a secret council very much. He had always longed to be a member of a guild, the kind possessed of arcane histories and feudal rankings and a code. Presently he became aware, however, that the hotelier did not appear to be listening very closely. Clinch had placed both palms of his hands flat on the desk before him, as though to steady himself against a wind, and during Mannering's long speech he had not once altered his posture, though his gaze darted anxiously around the room. His usually florid face was very pale, and his moustache was twitching.
"You look as if something's on your mind, I declare it," said Mannering at last,
and in a rather sulky tone, for he was sure that whatever this preoccupation was, it could hardly be as exciting as his afternoon in Chinatown, or the prospect of a secret conference to discuss the perplexing disappearance of a very wealthy man.
"The widow was here," said Edgar Clinch, hollowly. "She had business with Anna, she said. She went upstairs, and not half an hour later she was back down again with Anna in tow."
"Lydia Wells?"
"Lydia Wells," Clinch echoed.
In his mouth, her name was like a curse.
"When?"
"Just now," said Clinch. "They left together, the very moment before you got here."
He fell silent again. Mannering made an impatient noise.
"Don't make me beg you for it."
"They know each other," Clinch burst out. "They know each other, Lydia and Anna. They're the best of friends."
This revelation was not news to Mannering, who was a frequent patron of the House of Many Wishes in Dunedin, and had seen the two women together at that place before. In fact, it was at the House of Many Wishes that Mannering had first engaged Anna Wetherill to work for him. He shrugged.
"All right," he said. "What's the problem?"
"Thick as thieves," Clinch said mournfully.
"And thieves is right, Dick. Thieves is what I mean." "Who's a thief?"
"They're in on it together,"
Clinch cried. Really, Mannering thought, Clinch could be terribly irksome when he was vexed. He became altogether unintelligible. Aloud, he said,
"Is this about the widow's appeal?"
"You know what I'm talking about," Clinch said. "You know."
"What?"
Mannering said.
"Is it about the fortune?"
"What?"
Not the well's fortune. The other fortune.
What other fortune?
You know.
On the contrary, I've not the least idea.
I'm talking about Anna's dresses.
This was the first time Clinch had ever mentioned the gold he had discovered in Anna's dress the previous winter, when he carried her upstairs and lowered her into the bath, and he picked up her gown and felt a heaviness along the seam and broke the thread of the hem and withdrew in his fingers a shining pinch of it. The pressure of a long-time concealment lent an almost crazed aspect to his outburst now, for he was still convinced that the magnate was embroiled in a scheme of some kind, although he had never figured out exactly what this scheme might properly entail. But Mannering only looked confused.
"What?"
he said.
"What's all this about?"
Clinch was scowling.
"Don't play stupid."
"Excuse me, I'm doing no such thing," Mannering said. "What are you talking about, Edgar? What do a whore's fashions have to do with the price of anything at all?"
Studying him, Edgar Clinch felt a tremor of doubt. Mannering's bewilderment seemed perfectly genuine. He was not behaving like a man exposed. Could that mean that he had not known about the gold hidden in Anna's gowns? Could Anna have been colluding with quite another man behind Mannering's back? Clinch felt bewildered also. He decided to change the subject.
"I meant that morning gown," he said clumsily. "The one with the stupid collar that she's taken to wearing this past fortnight."
Mannering waved his hand.
"She's just being pious," he said. "Giving herself airs. It'll blow over."
"I'm not so sure," Clinch said. "Last week, you see, I told her she had to make good her debts before she quit walking the streets. And we had words, and I suppose I got angry and I threatened to turn her out of the hotel."
"What's that got to do with Lydia Wells?" said Mannering impatiently. "So you lost your temper. What's that got to do with anything?"
"Lydia Wells just paid Anna's debt," Clinch said.
At last he lifted his hands from the desk. Beneath them, slightly damp from the pressure of his palms, lay a crisp banknote made out for a sum of £6.
"Anna's gone over to the Wayfarer. Indefinitely. Got a new profession, she says. Won't answer to the name of whore."
Mannering looked at the banknote and did not speak for a moment.
"But that's her debt to you," he said at last. "That's just for rent. She owes me £100, and then some.